watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The circumstances surrounding this week's show are uncanny enough to almost give me religion. Several years ago, I read a book on the air that I think is one of the most important books ever written in understanding how hierarchies of power are maintained in this society. Through systems of indoctrination so effective they go largely unnoticed. Jeff Schmidt shone a light on the workings of this system in his landmark book, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, published in 2000. It exposed the political nature of professional work and how the system of professional education and credentialing sorts and molds these key intellectual workers to use their talents to support rather than challenge existing structures of power. Schmidt went through this system himself to receive a PhD in physics, but survived with his values intact, and his book is also in part a manual of resistance for those coming up through the process. As a result of its publication, Schmidt was fired from his job of 19 years as an editor of a prominent magazine for physicists. A few days ago, I was searching the web to see if there were any recent writings or lectures by him. I didn't find anything by Jeff Schmidt, but I discovered another physicist turned social analyst, Brian Martin, who's associate professor in science, technology, and society at the University of Wollongong in New South Wales, Australia. He's written extensively over decades on the suppression of dissent, especially in science, on effective whistleblowing, and the democratization of decision-making about technology. Think about it. Did anyone ever ask you whether you wanted a country littered with radioactive waste, or food with GMOs, or spy chips on your deodorant? Did anyone ever ask you what you wanted the government to fund in the way of scientific research? Why not? Typical excuses are that only experts are qualified to make such decisions, or that the market will decide. But these things are political decisions. They affect our lives. In November, voters transferred control of Congress from the Republicans to the Democrats. But before even being sworn in, the new Democratic Party leadership announced that everything that the voters thought they voted for was off the table, and instead of impeachment and troop withdrawal, they would be treated to troop increases and bipartisanship. One of the writings I found on Brian Martin's website seemed particularly timely at this point, even though the article was actually published in 1995. I decided I had to share it with you on the show this week. And it's quite a long article. After I recorded it, I discovered I still had time in the show for some other material. Here comes the uncanny part. Somebody had just uploaded an interview with Jeff Schmidt to the web, the person who originally inspired the search that led me to Brian Martin. So now we'll have something from Jeff Schmidt as well. After all, for the next 2 hours, a feast of resistance is on the table. So first to the article. It's titled, Democracy Without Elections, by Brian Martin, published in the 1995-96 edition of the journal Social Anarchism. Part 1, The Case Against Elections. For many a jaded radical, the Greens are the most exciting political development for ages. The Green movements claim to bring together members of the most dynamic social movements, including the peace, environmental, and feminist movements, combining their insights and numbers. This is something that many activists have long sought. Beyond this, the rapidly achieved electoral success of Green parties has really captured the imagination. The German Greens have been the center of attention for a decade precisely because of their election to Parliament. A number of other Green parties have been electorally successful too. But wait a moment. Before getting too carried away, isn't it worth asking whether elections are an appropriate way forward? After all, electoral politics is the standard traditional approach which has led to all those traditional parties which have so frustrated many a radical. Isn't there a danger that participation in the electoral process remains a trap, a bottomless pit for political energy which will pacify activists and masses alike? My aim here is to take a critical look at elections and their alternatives. I start in Part 1 with a summary of the case against elections. Much of this will be familiar to anarchists, but it may be useful in bringing together the arguments and perhaps raising one or two unfamiliar ones. If elections have limitations, then what are the alternatives? This is a harder question. In Part 2, I look at some of the methods favored by those supporting participatory democracy, namely actual rule by the people, rather than through elected representatives. These participatory methods, naturally enough, have both strengths and weaknesses. One of their key weaknesses is that it is hard for them to deal with decision-making involving large numbers of people without succumbing to some of the same problems as representative systems. Finally, in Part 3, I present the idea of demarchy, a participatory system based on random selection. This is, I believe, a most promising alternative. It is little known, but in recent years there have been important theoretical developments and practical experiences. 1. The Case Against Elections. The idea of elections as the ultimate democratic device is a deep-seated one in the West. It's hard to escape it. Children are taught all about elections in school, and many vote for student councils or club officers. Then, all around us, especially through the mass media, attention is given to politicians and periodically to the elections which put them in power. Indeed, the main connection which most people have with their rulers is the ballot box. It is no wonder that electoral politics is sanctified. If a country has no elections, or only sham elections, this is taken as a sign of failure. Elections in practice have served well to maintain dominant power structures such as private property, the military, male domination, and economic inequality. None of these has been seriously threatened through voting. It's from the point of view of radical critics that elections are most limiting. The theory of representative democracy and popular sovereignty is based on some hidden, convenient fictions. Here I'll concentrate on the practical shortcomings of electoral systems, though it would be possible to relate these to theoretical assumptions. Voting doesn't work. At the simplest level, voting simply doesn't work very well to promote serious challenges to prevailing power systems. The basic problem is quite simple. An elected representative is not tied in any substantial way to particular policies, whatever the preferences of the electorate. Influence on the politician is greatest at the time of election. Once elected, the representative is released from popular control. Recall is virtually impossible before the next election, but continues to be exposed to powerful pressure groups, especially corporations, state bureaucracies, and political party power brokers. We all know examples of politicians who have sold out, relinquishing their claimed ideals and breaking their solemn promises. Ironically, this is just as true for right-wingers as for left-wingers. The radical right was very disillusioned by Ronald Reagan. Usually the sellouts are attributed to failures of personalities, but this is both unfair and misleading. Politicians are morally little different from anyone else. The expectations and pressures on them are much greater. Positions of power both attract the most ambitious and ruthless people and bring out the worst features of those who obtain them. It's not the individuals who should be blamed, but the system in which they operate. In principle, elections should work all right for moderately small electorates and political systems, where accountability can be maintained through regular contact. Elections can be much better justified in New England town meetings than in national parliaments making decisions affecting millions of people. In these large systems, a whole new set of reinforcing mechanisms has developed. Political party machines, mass advertising, government manipulation of the news, pork barreling government projects in local areas, and bipartisan politics. The party machines choose the candidates, canvass voters, and impose platforms. Mass advertising treats candidates like soap powders, emphasizing personality over politics. Government manipulation of the news includes a variety of techniques by which the mass media become dependent on government suppliers and shapers of information. Government largesse in selected regions is a standard technique to attract or threaten voters. Finally, bipartisan politics, namely the adoption of identical or near-identical policies by allegedly competing parties, reduces the range of issues which are subject to political debate. In essence, voters are given the choice between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and then bombarded with a variety of techniques to sway them towards one or the other. This is a depressing picture, but hope springs eternal from the voter's pen. Some maintain the faith that a mainstream party may be reformed or radicalized. Others look towards new parties. When a new party such as the Greens shows principles and growth, it's hard to be completely cynical. Nevertheless, all the historical evidence suggests that the parties are more a drag than an impetus to radical change. One obvious problem is that the parties can be voted out. All the policy changes they brought in can simply be reversed later. More important, though, is the pacifying influence of the radical party itself. On a number of occasions, radical parties have been elected to power as a result of popular upsurges. Time after time, the radical parties have become chains to hold back the process of radical change. Ralph Miliband gives several examples where labor or socialist parties, elected in periods of social turbulence, acted to reassure the dominant capitalist class and subdue popular action. The Popular Front, elected in France in 1936, made its first task the ending of strikes and occupations and generally dampening popular militancy, which was the Front's strongest ally in bringing about change. The Labour government, elected in Britain in 1945, made as few reforms as possible, leaving basic social structures untouched. By contrast, the U.S. New Deal Democratic administration, which took office in 1933, did undertake structural changes in order to restore and strengthen capitalism. Miliband, in these examples, writes from the Marxist perspective, in which the state is the servant of capitalism. His insights about the reluctance of reforming political leadership of the state to challenge the economic foundation of society applies even more strongly to the unwillingness of this leadership to challenge state power itself. The experience of Euro-socialist parties elected to power in France, Greece, and Spain in the 1980s have followed the same pattern. In all major areas, the economy, the structure of state power and foreign policy, the Euro-socialist governments have retreated from their initial goals and become much more like traditional ruling parties. I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. Voting disempowers the grassroots. If voting simply didn't work to bring about changes at the top, that would not be a conclusive argument. After all, change in society doesn't just come about through laws and policies. As feminists and others say, the personal is political, and that means just about everything. There are plenty of opportunities for action outside the electoral system. It is here that voting makes a more serious inroad into radical social action. It is a diversion from grassroots action. The aim of electoral politics is to elect someone who can then take action. This means that instead of taking direct action against injustice, the action becomes indirect. Get the politicians to do something. On more than one occasion, I've seen a solid grassroots campaign undermined by an election. One example is the 1977 Australian federal election in the midst of a powerful campaign against uranium mining. Another is the Australian federal election at a crucial point in the campaign against the flooding of the Franklin River in Tasmania. At the simplest level, energy put into electioneering is energy not put into direct action. Some activists feel resentful that their campaign is hijacked by election priorities. This can be compensated to some extent by the heightened interest in the issues during an election campaign. The more serious problem is the loss of energy that usually occurs after the election. In the December 1977 election, the pro-uranium Liberal Party was re-elected. This was very demoralizing for the anti-uranium movement, which had looked with hope for a victory by the Australian Labor Party with its new anti-uranium platform. Yet in retrospect, the movement was having considerable success even under the Liberals. A stepped-up campaign should have been called for, but this was hard to achieve. Many anti-uranium activists, notably those who were Labor Party members, had participated in 1977 because of the upcoming election. After Labor's defeat, many of them dropped out of the movement, leaving those remaining feeling less than encouraged. The election campaign was a diversion from long-term strategy against uranium. It raised activity temporarily, to be followed by a more persistent decline. Another problem is the centralization of power in social movements, which is encouraged by the desire to influence politicians. The campaign against the flooding of the Franklin River in Tasmania illustrates this. A long and well-orchestrated campaign by a variety of means culminated in December 1982 in a blockade against construction work on the dam, using classic nonviolent action techniques. During the blockade, a national election was called for March of 1983. The leaders of the Tasmanian Wilderness Society and the Australian Conservation Foundation negotiated with the leaders of the Australian Labor Party and made a deal. The conservationists would support Labor for the House of Representatives. Labor, if elected, would act to stop the dam. My main point here is the undemocratic fashion in which deals are made in the political system. It's also interesting to note the aftermath of these negotiations. The blockade was downgraded. Labor, with support of the mainstream environmental organizations, won a close election. The new Labor government did not use its financial power directly against the dam, but rather just supported a legal action in the High Court to use federal power in relation to a World Heritage listing to stop a state project. This case won by one vote in the High Court. During all this time, the environmentalists were disempowered, waiting for powerful politicians and judges to decide the fate of the river. The aftermath was a powerful backlash in Tasmania, using the rhetoric of states' rights against environmentalists. Incidentally, the 1983 Labor government decided to renege on several remaining planks of its anti-uranium platform. The anti-uranium movement reemerged on Labor's election and sank again after this betrayal. It should be a truism that elections empower the politicians and not the voters. Yet many social movements continually are drawn into electoral politics. There are several reasons for this. One is the involvement of party members in social movements. Another is the aspirations for power and influence by leaders in movements. Having the ear of a government minister is a heady sensation for many. Getting elected to parliament oneself is even more of an ego boost. What is forgotten in all this politics of influence is the effect on ordinary activists. The disempowering effect of elections works not only on activists but also on others. The ways in which elections serve the interests of state power have been admirably explained by Benjamin Ginsburg. Ginsburg's basic thesis is that elections historically have enlarged the number of people who participate in politics, but by turning this involvement into a routine activity, voting, elections have reduced the risk of more radical direct action. The expansion of suffrage is typically presented as a triumph of downtrodden groups against privilege. Workers gained the vote in the face of opposition by the propertied class. Women gained it in the face of male-dominated governments and electorates. Ginsburg challenges this picture. He argues that the suffrage in many countries was expanded in times when there was little social pressure for it. Why should this be? Basically, voting serves to legitimate government. To bolster its legitimacy, if required, suffrage can be expanded. This is important when mass support is crucial, for example, during wartime. It can be seen in other areas as well. Worker representatives on corporate boards of management serve to co-opt dissent. So do student representatives on university councils. Ginsburg shows that elections operate to bring mass political activity into a manageable form, election campaigns and voting. People learn that they can participate. They are not totally excluded. They also learn the limits of participation. Voting occurs only occasionally, at times fixed by governments. Voting serves only to select leaders, not to directly decide policy. Finally, voting doesn't take passion into account. The vote of the indifferent or ill-informed voter counts just the same as that of the concerned and knowledgeable voter. Voting thus serves to tame political participation, making it a routine process that avoids mass uprisings. The expansion of suffrage helps to reduce the chance that a revolt by an oppressed or excluded group will be seen as justified. With a vote, it's easy for others to claim that they should have used orthodox channels. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. Voting reinforces state power. Ginsburg's most important point is that elections give citizens the impression that the government does or can serve the people. The founding of the modern state a few centuries ago was met with great resistance. People would refuse to pay taxes, to be conscripted, or to obey laws passed by national governments. The introduction of voting and the expanded suffrage have greatly aided the expansion of state power. Rather than seeing the system as one of ruler and ruled, people see at least the possibility of using state power to serve themselves. As electoral participation has increased, the degree of resistance to taxation, military service, and the immense variety of laws regulating behavior has been greatly attenuated. The irony in all this, as pointed out by Ginsburg, is that the expansion of state power, legitimated by voting, has now outgrown any control by the participation which made it possible. States are now so large and complex that any expectation of popular control seems remote. Yet, as he comments, the idea that electoral participation means popular control of government is so deeply implanted in the psyches of most Americans that even the most overtly skeptical cannot fully free themselves from it. Close quote. Needless to say, this statement applies to many countries besides the United States. Using Ginsburg's perspective, The initial government-sponsored introduction of some competition into elections in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe takes on a new meaning. If the economic restructuring seen as necessary by Communist Party leaders was to have any chance of success, then there had to be greater support for the government. What better way than by introducing some choice into voting? Increased government legitimacy, and hence increased real power for the government, was the aim. Change in Eastern Europe has gone far past that planned by governments, of course. Still, it is revealing that a key demand of reformers has been to introduce multi-party elections. What is sought is a change in the running of government, not in the basic mechanisms of governance. Though expanding the franchise does help legitimate government, it certainly does not close off political struggle. The introduction of voting and the expansion of suffrage may institutionalize political activity, but they do, after all, allow activity. Elections may reduce the chance of radical challenges to the status quo, but that chance does exist. Electoral politics legitimates government to the extent that governments are to some extent dependent on the will of the people, however routinized and institutionalized the expression of the people's will may be. Because elections provide a channel for radical change, even though a very constrained channel, the hope of radicals is maintained and their reliance on elections is encouraged. Ginsburg's analysis leads to the third major limitation of electoral politics. It relies on the state and reinforces state power. Of course, this is simply another facet of the two previous objections, namely that elections don't work to bring about radical change because the state machinery is designed for other interests, and that elections disempower the grassroots because energy is channeled into the state. The basis of an anarchist critique of voting is that voting participates in the legitimation of the state. If the state is part of the problem, namely being a prime factor in war, genocide, repression, economic inequality, male domination, and environmental destruction, then it is foolish to expect that the problems can be overcome by electing a few new nominal leaders of the state. It is possible to paint a more sophisticated picture of the state, in which there are continual struggles inside and outside the state apparatuses to shape policies and to serve and empower different groups of people. In this picture, it is worth struggling within the state, for example, for welfare measures for the poor or against aggressive military policies. There are few who would object to this, but even with this more sophisticated picture, the fundamental critique of the state can still apply. The basic point concerns whether the organizational structure of the state is neutral or not. If the structure of the state is assumed to be neutral, then the exercise of state power can be seen as the playing out of various power struggles, such as capitalist power versus workers' power or male power versus female power. If the structure of the state is neutral, then the state can be seen as a site for class struggle, gender struggle, etc. This is a typical perspective adopted by Marxists, some feminists, and most liberals. It is quite an improvement from the picture of the state as a complete tool of the capitalist class. But it does not question the basic assumption of the neutrality of the state structure, which as a consequence can be captured one way or another, either by the simplistic image of taking state power, or by the more sophisticated image of working in and against the state. The basic anarchist insight is that the structure of the state, as a centralized administrative apparatus, is inherently flawed from the point of human freedom and equality. Even though the state can be used occasionally for valuable ends, as a means, the state is flawed and impossible to reform. The non-reformable aspects of the state include, centrally, its monopoly over, quote, legitimate violence, and its consequent power to coerce for the purpose of war, internal control, taxation, and the protection of property and bureaucratic privilege. The problem with voting is that the basic premises of the state are never considered open for debate, much less challenge. The state's monopoly over the use of violence for war is never at issue. Neither is the state's use of violence against revolt from within. The state's right to extract economic resources from the population is never questioned. Neither is the state's guarantee of either private property under capitalism or bureaucratic prerogative under state socialism, or both. Voting can lead to changes in policies. That is fine and good. But the policies are developed and executed within the state framework, which is a basic constraint. Voting legitimates the state framework. One response to the limitations of electoral politics is to campaign against voting and elections. This is useful in raising awareness of the limitations of electing one's rulers, but such a critique needs to be supplemented by the promotion of alternatives to the state. That is a harder task. After all, there's no use in criticizing electoral methods if there isn't anything better. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. Part 2, Alternatives to Elections. What participatory alternatives are there to the state and electoral politics? This is a topic on which there is a large literature, especially by anarchists. So I can do no more than highlight some of the relevant answers and experiences. I will emphasize some of the limitations of the standard responses to this problem, since it is essential to be as critical of alternatives as of the existing system. Referendums. One set of alternatives is based on direct mass involvement in policymaking through voting, using mechanisms including petition, recall, initiative, and referendum. In short, instead of electing politicians who then make policy decisions, these decisions are made directly by the public. Referendums have been used widely in the United States, often to the consternation of powerful groups. The fluoridation of public water supplies as a measure to reduce tooth decay has resulted in hundreds of referendums, for example. The more frequent result has been against fluoridation, much to the consternation of proponents, who as a result have counseled against referendums and tried for implementation directly by governments. In practice, referendums have been only supplements to a policy process based on elected representatives. But it is possible to conceive of a vast expansion of the use of referendums, especially by use of computer technology. Some exponents propose a future in which each household television system is hooked up with equipment for direct electronic voting. The case for and against a referendum proposal would be broadcast, followed by a mass vote. What could be more democratic? Unfortunately, there are some serious flaws in such proposals. These go deeper than the problems of media manipulation, involvement by big spending vested interests, and the worries by experts and elites that the public will be irresponsible in direct voting. A major problem is the setting of the agenda for the referendum. Who decides the questions? Who decides what material is broadcast for and against a particular question? Who decides the wider context of voting? The fundamental issue concerning setting of the agenda is not simply bias. It's a question of participation. Participation in decision-making means not just voting on pre-designed questions, but participation in the formulation of which questions are put to a vote. This is something which is not easy to organize when a million people are involved, even with the latest electronics. It is a basic limitation of referendums. Key to this limitation of referendums is the presentation of a single choice to a large number of voters. Even when some citizens are involved in developing the question, as in the cases of referendums based on the process of citizen initiative, most people have no chance to be involved in more than a yes-no capacity. The opportunity to recast the question in the light of discussion is not available. Another problem for referendums is a very old one, fundamental to voting itself. Simply put, rule by the majority often means oppression of the minority. This problem is more clear-cut in direct voting systems, but also appears in representative systems. Historically, the referendum approach assumes the existence of a bureaucratic apparatus for implementing the decisions made. Referendums don't implement themselves, certainly. Who does? The state. Referendums in practice are a way of increasing participation within the parameters of centralized administration. This latter problem is not intrinsic to the referendum as a method. The challenge is to recast the referendum as part of a more participatory political process. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. Consensus decision-making has become widely used in a number of social movements in the past couple of decades, especially in portions of the anti-nuclear power movement. In general parlance, consensus means gaining general agreement, but within social movements, it's been given a more precise operational meaning. The basic aim is for a group of generally like-minded people to reach a common decision without greatly alienating anyone. This might be a collective working on a newspaper, or a group planning a direct action against a military facility. Voting is avoided for several reasons. Those who lose a close or bitterly contested vote often fail to support the majority position, and sometimes even end up leaving the group. Lots of energy is wasted in lobbying and building factions for the purpose of winning votes rather than developing the best campaign. Finally, innovative proposals are often ignored because they seem to stand no chance in a vote. The basic procedure in consensus decision-making is that various options are canvassed and discussed. If everyone seems to be agreeing, then a test is made for consensus. If no one disagrees, consensus has been reached. If anyone disagrees, they are encouraged to spell out their objections. Consensus is blocked if there is strong disagreement by even one person, or in modified consensus by a specified small fraction. If consensus is blocked, then the group seeks ways to reach agreement. The arguments can be re-examined, new proposals can be raised and discussed, the decision can be postponed until a later time. For example, the group may break itself into a number of small groups which readdress the issue, seeking a resolution. In many cases, the procedure works remarkably well. Those with divergent views generally see that they are taken seriously, and this builds the cohesion of the group. Sometimes a minority view eventually becomes the consensus view. There is no quick vote to overwhelm it. Most encouraging of all, sometimes brilliant new solutions are developed in the efforts to reach consensus. That consensus methods often work well should come as no surprise, since they have been long used in an unacknowledged manner in all sorts of situations. For many organizations, official votes are ritualistic only. A vote is seldom taken unless it is obvious beforehand that everyone agrees, or at least that no one strongly disagrees. The practice of consensus decision-making formalizes the process. This is most important as the group gets larger. For large groups, there are various methods involving subgroups and delegates, which ensure that the basic consensus approach is followed. An important difference between consensus and normal meeting procedure is the role of leadership. The conventional method has a formal leader, the chair, and a set of formal rules for setting the agenda, speaking, making motions, voting, etc., the familiar Robert's Rules of Order. The consensus approach has no formal leader, but instead facilitators, who are supposed to help the group to do what it wants to. The facilitators are crucial to the success of consensus. They are supposed to test for consensus, encourage less articulate group members to participate, offer suggestions for procedure, summarize views expressed, etc. The idea is when every group member helps in facilitation, So there is no obvious leader at all. Consensus, then, is a method of decision-making without voting, but it aims for participation, group cohesion, and openness to new ideas. Combined with other group skills for social analysis, examining group dynamics, developing strategies, and evaluation, consensus can be powerful indeed. Yet anyone who has participated in consensus decision-making should be aware that the practice is often far short of the theory. Sometimes powerful personalities dominate the process. Less confident people are afraid to express their views. Because objections normally have to be voiced face-to-face, the protection of anonymity in the secret ballot is lost. Meetings can be interminable, and those who cannot devote the required time to them are effectively disenfranchised. The biggest problem for consensus, though, is irreconcilable conflict of interest. The best treatment of this problem is Beyond Adversary Democracy by Jane Mansbridge. Mansbridge distinguishes between two types of democracy. What she calls adversary democracy is the familiar electoral approach. It's based on the assumption of conflicting interests, majority rule, secret ballot, and equal protection of interests. What she calls unitary democracy is like friendship. It's based on a high degree of common interest, consensus-like methods, face-to-face decision-making, and a rough equality of mutual respect. Mansbridge closely analyzes two cases in detail: a New England town meeting which formally uses voting, but in practice often seeks consensus, and a work collective which uses formal consensus methods. Mansbridge points out that the standard approach is to assume conflicting interests and to use adversarial methods, but that unitary interests are much more common than generally realized. Hence, seeking unity rather than assuming conflict is often preferable. Her most important point, though, for my purposes here, is that consensus has a complementary weakness. It can't handle deep-seated conflict. Much of such conflict is based in inequality of power. To imagine employers and workers in a typical enterprise trying to reach consensus is difficult. They don't have common interests or very often equality of respect. In a self-managed enterprise, by contrast, there are no separate employers and consensus becomes more feasible. Other types of conflict are just as difficult to deal with. Imagine a group of anarchists, Marxists, liberals, with a few conservatives tossed in for good measure, trying to reach consensus on a campaign for reducing crime. Even with the best will in the world, the different perspectives on the world are likely to undermine attempts at consensus on more than the most superficial level. The larger the group, the more likely there are to be fundamental conflicts of interests. Consensus is most likely to work in small, self-selected groups. But as a democratic alternative to elections, it has severe limitations dealing with large groups. The problems of consensus are also the problems of self-management in large groups. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections by Brian Martin. One solution to this dilemma is to keep group sizes small. Rather than centralization of power, decentralization is the aim. There is no intrinsic reason why education, health, investment, and many other functions have to be administered at the level of many millions of people, rather than, say, thousands or tens of thousands. Many of the most participatory polities from ancient Greece to today have been relatively small. Conversely, many of the ills of electoral politics seem associated with the enormous population in many countries. Small size reduces the severity of many of the problems of decision-making. Even voting is not so limiting when the number of voters is so small that everyone is potentially known to everyone else. The use of consensus can be maximized. Furthermore, small size opens the possibility of a plurality of political systems. Francis Kendall and Leon Liu propose a Swiss-like federation of autonomous political entities each of which can choose its own political and economic system. With Kendall and Liu's system, the difficulties of trying new methods and the costs of failure are greatly reduced. Small size may make governance easier, but there will still be some large-scale problems requiring solution. Global pollution and local disasters, for example, call for more than local solutions. How are decisions to be made about such issues? More fundamentally, small size by itself doesn't solve the issue of how decisions are made. There can still be deep conflicts of interests which make consensus inappropriate, and there can still be problems of domination resulting from electoral methods. Finally, in all but the very tiniest groups, the basic problem of limits to participation remains. Not everyone has time to become fully knowledgeable about every issue. Consensus assumes that everyone can and should participate in decisions. If substantial numbers drop out, it becomes rule by the energetic or by those who have nothing better to do. Representative democracy, by contrast, puts elected representatives in the key decision-making roles. The participation of everyone else is restricted to campaigning, voting, and lobbying. In both cases, participation is very unequal, not by choice, but by the structure of the decision-making system. Delegates and federations. A favorite anarchist solution to the problem of coordination and participation is delegates and federations. A delegate differs from a representative in that the delegate is more closely tied to the electorate. The delegate can be recalled at any time, especially when not following the dictates of the electors. Federations are a way of combining self-governing entities. The member bodies in the federation retain the major decision-making power over their own affairs. The members come together to decide issues affecting all of them. In a weak federation, the center has only advisory functions. In a strong federation, the center has considerable executive power in specified areas. By having several tiers in the federation, full participation can be ensured at the bottom level, and consultation and some decision-making occurs at the highest levels. Delegates and federations sound like an alternative to conventional electoral systems, but there are strong similarities. Delegates are normally elected, and this leads to the familiar problems of representation. Certain individuals dominate. Participation in decision-making is unequal, with the delegates being heavily involved and others not. To the degree that decisions are actually made at higher levels, there is great potential for development of factions, vote trading, and manipulation of the electorate. This is where the delegate system is supposed to be different. If the delegates start to serve themselves rather than those they represent, they can be recalled. But in practice, this is hard to achieve. Delegates tend to harden into formal representatives. Those chosen as delegates are likely to have much more experience and knowledge than the ordinary person. Once chosen, the delegates gain even more experience and knowledge, which can be presented as of high value to the electors. In other words, recalling the delegate will be at the cost of losing an experienced and influential person. These problems have surfaced in the German Green Party. Although formally elected as representatives, the party sought to treat those elected as delegates, setting strict limits on the length of time in parliament. This was resisted by some of those elected, who were able to build support due to their wide appeal. Furthermore, from a pragmatic point of view, which is often hard to resist, those who had served in parliament had the experience and public profile to better promote the Green cause. Thus, the delegate approach came under great stress, even though the Green politicians had little real power. In a situation where the delegates are truly making decisions, the stresses will be much greater. The fundamental problem with the delegate system, then, is unequal participation. Not everyone can be involved in every issue. With delegates, the problem is resolved by having the delegates involved much more in decision-making, at the expense of others. This unequal participation then reproduces and entrenches itself. The more layers there are to the Federation, the more serious the problem will be. Federations, as well, are not a magical solution to the problem of coordination in a self-managing society. In this brief survey of some of the more well-known participative alternatives to elections, I've focused on their limitations. But these and other methods do have many strengths and are worth promoting as additions or alternatives to the present system. Consensus has been developed enormously over the past couple of decades as a practical decision-making method. The potential of decentralization is undoubtedly great. Indeed, the greatest successes of consensus have been in small groups. As well as the idea of federations, there is also much attention to networks, which do not assume any set levels for decision-making. Rather than dismissing these possibilities, my aim is to point out some of the problems that confront them. A most serious difficulty is how to ensure participation in a wide range of issues that affect any person. How can the self-managed activities of large numbers of people be coordinated without vesting excessive power in a small group of people? I turn now to demarchy, which is one answer to some of these problems. It is by no means the only or final answer, but it is an approach that holds potential and, in my opinion, is worth much investigation and experimentation. John Zuby advocates panarchy, the peaceful coexistence of a diversity of methods for voluntary association. In this spirit, demarchy can be considered as one candidate for organizing society in a participative fashion. And I'm reading from Democracy Without Elections, written by Dr. Brian Martin of Wollongong University of New South Wales, Australia. This article was published in 1995 in the journal Social Anarchism. You're tuned to WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilof Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. And the third and final section, demarchy. The most eloquent account of demarchy is given by John Bernheim in his book, Is Democracy Possible? Bernheim begins by analyzing the state and bureaucracy and concludes that they are central obstacles to the achievement of true democracy. He includes electoral politics as part of the problem. Since the word democracy is so tainted by association with representative government, Bernheim coined the word demarchy to refer to his alternative. Demarchy is based on random selection of individuals to serve in decision-making groups which deal with particular functions or services, such as roads or education. Forget the state and forget bureaucracies. In a full-fledged demarchy, all this is replaced by a network of groups whose members are randomly selected, each of which deals with a particular function in a particular area. For example, in a population of 10,000 to 100,000, there might be groups dealing with transport, health, agriculture, industry, education, garbage, housing, art, and so forth, or particular aspects of such functions, such as rail transport. Each group would be chosen randomly from all those who volunteer to be on it. The groups could contain perhaps 10 or 20 people, large enough to obtain a variety of views, but small enough for face-to-face discussion. The groups themselves could use consensus, modified consensus, voting, or some other procedure to reach decisions. They could call for submissions, testimony, surveys, and any other information they wish to obtain. Before going further, it's worth looking more closely at random selection, also called sortition. This was used in ancient Athens as a democratic selection device, but has been little used since. Of course, Athenian democracy was limited, excluding women and slaves. Nevertheless, there are many things that can be learned from it. One of the values of random selection was to increase participation and prevent the formation of factions. When the assembly met, the chairman was selected by lot at the beginning of the meeting. In this way, there was no opportunity for pre-assembly plotting to push forward particular outcomes by putting pressure on the chairman. Athenians used voting, too, for example, in choosing military leaders. In fact, they used a variety of democratic devices, each chosen for particular purposes. Writers on liberal democracy today draw on the Athenian experience selectively. They use it to justify representation, but ignore or dismiss the use of sortition. Indeed, democracy is often defined today as representative democracy. The major use of random selection for important decision-making today is the jury, which itself prospers only in the United States and a few other countries. Quote, ordinary people are randomly chosen to decide on the fate of their fellow humans. The jury is embedded in a political framework which constrains its potential, the framework of laws which is biased toward the interests of the privileged, the selective enforcement of law, manipulations by lawyers, judges, and media. Considering these obstacles, the jury performs remarkably well. Many governments have dispensed with juries, arguing that professional judges are more suitable. The argument that juries are less capable of dealing with complex technical issues is a vexed one. Arguably, a jury of a dozen people is likely to contain one or two people more technically competent than the average judge. It is certainly the case that juries are hated by repressive governments. Judges can be pressured more easily by governments than can juries. From a decision-making point of view, the great advantage of the jury is its capacity for testing opinions. In terms of participation in decision-making, the jury is a form of policy-making, though this is greatly discouraged by most judges. Considering that most jury members are given no training in critical assessment of evidence and formation of conclusions, in consensus decision-making techniques, or in the role of the jury itself, the decision-making record of juries is remarkably sound. Rather than attacking the failures of the jury system, it would be more appropriate to develop ways of making it function better. Returning now to Bernheim's picture of demarchy, how does it handle the basic problems of participation? Because there are no elections and no representatives, the problems of unequal formal power, disempowerment of electors, regulation of participation, and so forth do not apply, at least not in the usual way. Formal participation occurs instead through random selection onto functional groups, namely groups dealing with particular limited areas. Random selection for each group is made only from those who volunteer, just as politicians must volunteer. The difference is the method of selection. Random selection, rather than election.